All right. Welcome everybody to the Smooth Brain Society. I am Sahid. And today with us, we have Dr. Tim Kahn. He is a professor at Western Sydney University, where he continues his preclinical research into schizophrenia and Alzheimer's disease. Although the real reason he is here today is because he investigates the detrimental and potentially beneficial properties of cannabis and the use of cannabis in treatment or in its effect on brain disorders. So welcome, Professor Kahn, to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
And as always, we have a co-host. Today, our co-host is Therese Broderick. She was on last time as a guest herself, talking about the politics in New Zealand. But now she's been gracious enough to flip that around and now be a guest be a co-host to someone who is now on the neurobiology side of things. So moving away from social psychology, this would be interesting. So yeah, welcome, Therese.
Thank you. You go.
I was just going to say I'll let you get started.
Okay, cool. If you have a question. So as a social psychologist, if we could bring it to basics for me for understanding, how does cannabis affect or impact the brain?
So cannabis impacts the brain in a way because there is already an endocannabinoid system available in the brain. So that means we have already a setup in the brain with receptors and neurotransmitters and enzymes which process these neurotransmitters, which are very similar to what happens when you use cannabis. So if you smoke cannabis, the cannabinoids within the plant activate this system in the brain and then produce certain behavioral effects which people are aware of when they consume cannabis in one way or the other. The two main receptors which are related to this system are the cannabinoid receptor 1 and 2, where the cannabinoid receptor 1 is the one which gives you the particular high people feel when they use recreational cannabis, but it also drives a lot of the other effects in terms of anxiety, in terms of cognition, so learning and memory, in terms of sedation, some of the effects of cannabis which are known to affect pain perception, for example, are also driven by this receptor. So it is basically a plant material which has components in the plant. There can be up to 100 different cannabinoids. That's sometimes for people hard to understand. It's a very complex plant. So a lot of people talk about THC, delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol. And they also talk about CBD cannabidiol, but there are at least another 80 or 90 other cannabinoids in the cannabis plant, and they access the system in the brain and therefore have effects on your behavior and potentially, because that is obviously what I research, also your risk to develop certain diseases.
Cool. Is there a reason that we already have a cannabinoid system in the brain? Is there one for why we already have this?
So it has obviously quite a few important. So the reason is obviously that certain processes in the brain has to be driven by systems and by neurotransmitters which are available, and the cannabinoid system has been evolutionary established quite a while ago, so you also find it in lots of different animal species. So it's highly conserved, and it's also the CB1 receptor, for example, is highly expressed in the brain. So you find it in nearly all areas of the brain. The reason why we have this system is that obviously certain behaviors, certain physiological responses of your body have to be controlled by one system or another, and the endocannabinoid system is available to address or to trigger and mediate certain behavioral responses. It also, for example, has a quite important role within the immune system, This is why we, for example, look at the cannabinoids as a therapeutic option, because in a lot of diseases, you have an increased level of inflammation in the brain, and the cannabinoid system is able to combat or reduce this inflammation in the brain. And these are some of the roles the system has taken on, and evolutionary, I can't tell you why it was done via the endocannabinoid system and not another one, but evolutionary, it has evolved to be the one of the main systems which you can target to achieve some of the therapeutic effects we are interested in the context of the research we are doing in my lab.
Nice. A few other questions come to mind. The first one is, well, still on the, I guess, on the evolutionary side of things. Does our body produce something naturally which activates these systems? Is that why we have them? Or are there other things apart from, because when we think of cannabis, we just think of, you know, the plant and smoking it and so on. How are these activated naturally per se without, use of any external drugs?
Yes, so there are two, and we call them endocannabinoids compared to the external cannabinoids, which you, for example, would get from the cannabis plant. So there are two endocannabinoids already in our brain. The one is 2-AG, and the other one is AEG or anandamide. And those two are produced and help with moderating some of the symptoms or some of the behavioral effects, for example, I alerted to. And these are ingrained into the brain. They are produced by the brain. The receptors are set up for these endocannabinoids. So CB1, CB2 are basically have evolved to be able to communicate with these neurotransmitters. However, because we can access external cannabis, you can also obviously activate them by abusing cannabis. And therefore, yes, there's an endogenous system available which works on itself. But people who abuse cannabis are then activating this basically from the outside to trigger similar effects as you would find in the brain anyway.
Cool. That's pretty interesting to know because I guess not dispels the notion, but at least common knowledge is probably not that. So the cannabinoid system, you said it affects a lot of functions in the brain, affects a lot of regions. Could you probably give us an insight into one or two of them as to how they probably work? Maybe one's more relevant to your research.
So you mean in terms of how the cannabinoids impact on the release of other neurotransmitters, or are you rather behind the behavioral effects they are inducing?
Maybe we could start with the neurotransmitters first. What do you think, Therese? And then we can talk about behaviors after.
So when cannabinoids are used, it affects, and I have to clarify, I'm not a cannabinoid researcher, so I look at the effects of cannabinoids on behavioral systems and on brain disorders. So if you want to delve into the details of what cannabinoids are specifically doing on, for example, a neuron level, you probably should talk to a cannabinoid pharmacologist because that's really outside my area. But strictly speaking, the cannabinoids are endocannabinoids or external cannabinoids like the phytocannabinoids. They target the endocannabinoid systems, also CB1 or CB2 receptors, for example. And the cannabinoid receptors, a G protein coupled receptors, and they can activate or inhibit a number of internal signal transduction pathways. I can delve into this more. I'm not sure how easily understandable that is for your audience. So it inhibits, for example, calcium channels and sodium channels at the neuron level. It also inhibits A-type potassium channels, activates potassium channels which are inward rectifying, and those effects, for example, could result in changes in the dopamine level on the brain level, and that can lead to euphoria amongst other effects. So that would be on a neuron level what cannabinoids are actually doing. by opening and closing certain channels, resulting in the release of other neurotransmitters, which then induce behavioral effects in the patient or in people who recreationally use cannabis. Mm-hmm. That's probably quite theoretical.
You know, it was very theoretical. yeah, so let's talk about the behavior then. That's better.
So there are different cannabinoids have quite a few effects. So the main effects people, and I stay away at the moment from what might be therapeutically relevant for cannabis consumption. The main ones people talk about when you just think back in the days about the recreational use, people might experience a high if the dose is sufficient enough. People might, dependent on the dose, and that's where it starts already to be quite complex. If you have used a high dose THC cannabis strain, for example, you might experience increased anxiety. If you use low dose THC cannabis strains, you might have a reduction in anxiety. If you have abused cannabis for a long time, it might actually impact on your ability to perform well in cognitive tests. So it might impair to a degree your learning and memory. However, nowadays, cannabinoids are also looked at in regards to improving cognition in Alzheimer's. So again, it depends very much on what strain of cannabis you might be abusing or you might have access to. Cannabinoids can reduce body temperature. If you use very high dose THC, it reduces, so we call it a sedative-like effect. So it would inhibit your interest to move around. So as you alerted to, I do preclinical research. So if we use high dose THC in rodents, they, for example, don't move as much anymore. So they are slightly sedated. But then coming into the therapeutic arena, cannabinoids have been shown, for example, to have anticonvulsant effects. So that's why they're at the moment looked at or have, to a degree at least, already been established as an effective treatment for epilepsy or certain types of epilepsy. It can also have effects on your social abilities. So if you use high dose or high, THC enriched strains, it might reduce your drive to socially interact with other people and might actually result in something which is called social withdrawal, which is relevant for schizophrenia. That's why cannabis abuse, at least at certain times of your development, is seen as a risk factor for developing schizophrenia. So these are some of the behavioral effects people are aware of when they talk about cannabis abuse. So you have the high, it has an impact on anxiety, but it really depends on the dose. It can have an impact on your cognitive abilities. It can be sedative, again, all dose dependent, but it also might have some beneficial effects, including being an anticonvulsant.
Did I hear you correctly in saying that while typically the idea is that cannabis will reduce cognitive functioning or impact cognitive functioning in a negative way, that for Alzheimer's patients it might improve cognitive, or did I mishear what you said?
No, that is correct, and that's where the complexity comes in, and it really also depends a little bit on who you would talk to. So, as said, I'm not a cannabinoid researcher per se. I use preclinical research models to understand risk factors of certain brain disorders and to also look at potential therapeutics. So when I go to cannabis-focused or cannabinoid research-focused conferences, a lot of times the focus is on some of the positive effects of cannabinoids. And that can include that. And I'm not talking about THC here. That is very important. I talk about cannabidiol, CBD, my own research, but that's followed up by others. And others have done this now also to a degree, at least in clinical trials. When you look at cannabidiol, CBD in a mouse model for Alzheimer's, where you know that mice over a period of time develop cognitive deficits. If you treat these animals with CBD, they do better in cognitive tasks after they have received this treatment over a period of time. So in that regard, it improves the cognition of these animals, or to be more accurate, it reduces the cognitive decline of these animals. However, if I use a mouse model which isn't affected by Alzheimer's, so they are normal, healthy mice, and you would expose them chronically, so over a period of time, to a high-dose THC, so delta-9-tetrahydrocannabinol, and you test the animals at the end for their cognitive performance. So how good can they learn? How good can they memorize? These animals depend on the dose, dependent on how long you have exposed them to THC for. These animals might show actually reduced cognitive abilities. So they will take longer to learn. They might not memorize as much to learn. And then to make it even more complex, there's one study from Germany, which was published, I think, 5 or 6 years ago, where they tested in aging mice. So the animals were not Alzheimer's mice or had a genetic modification, which would make them close to an Alzheimer's related model system. But so these animals were just aging mice. They were around 2 years old, and they exposed them to low dose THC. And at the low dose, at this advanced age, it actually reduced the aging-related cognitive decline of these animals. So depending on who you ask and depending on what they are talking about, people will tell you cannabinoids potentially have the ability to improve cognition. But in all likelihood, that's not linked to the effects of THC. If people talk about that cannabinoids or cannabis impairs your cognitive effects or your cognitive abilities, say in all likelihood talk about high dose THC. So it really depends on who you're talking to and what type of studies and what type of cannabis exposure they're referring to. It gets even more complex. So if you look at these animals which have initially been treated with high dose THC at a young age, and then you test them there for their cognitive behaviors, and they do worse because they had high dose THC for an extended period of time. If you test them, let's say 2 months later again, but they don't have any THC exposure during this time, they might actually have come back to the normal levels of animals which never had seen cannabis in their life. So it's not necessarily a chronic effect on the cognition, but it's a relatively short-term effect that if you abuse cannabis, or if you have recently abused cannabis, talking about the mice here, that these animals then show an impairment in cognition. So yes, it's basically dependent on what cannabinoid you're talking to you about, what dose you're referring to. You can argue both. You could argue it actually improves cognition, or it might be actually detrimental for your cognitive performance. And this is why you find all sorts of media announcements regarding what cannabis is doing, because people quite often don't consider that it is a complex plant, that people, when they use it recreationally, in all likelihood, it's, for example, very high in THC, because that gives you your high, but that might have a detrimental effect on your cognition. Whereas when people talk about cannabis potentially being used as an Alzheimer's treatment, they normally talk about cannabis, which is very low in THC, but very high in CBD. But if you buy cannabis on the recreational market or the illegal market, it's in all likelihood high in THC and low in CBD. So it's really dependent on what you are talking about and what you're looking at in particular.
Oh, that was really good. I think that part needs to be clipped out and played again and again. Like, you need to remember there's a difference between THC and CBD. And when people are talking about these things in research, they're very specific about it, but the media doesn't. And then can cause issues in terms of result interpretation.
Yeah, I can give you one example. The first study we published on Alzheimer's disease transgenic mice, so animals which are genetically modified, that they develop a kind of behavior and a kind of brain pathology which is relevant to Alzheimer's. The animals not have really Alzheimer's disease, but they have certain aspects of Alzheimer's disease, and therefore we can test them. We exposed them to purified cannabidiol, CBD. So no cannabis, there was no THC involved. It was a purified compound, just cannabidiol. We published that in a medical journal and just stated that if you expose animals to purified CBD, they do better in behavioral tests afterwards, which tests for learning and memory. The first news outlet which covered the story said cannabis is treating Alzheimer's disease, which was very far removed from what we actually had done. We hadn't used cannabis. We hadn't even used THC. We hadn't used any of the other 100 cannabinoids. But obviously, it was a way better story to say cannabis treats Alzheimer's disease. And after that, I got lots of people who wrote to me and said, listen, so can I get somewhere? And that was before cannabis became, or medicinal cannabis became legal or at least accessible to people in Australia. I had lots of people who asked me if they now can use the recreationally use cannabis to help their relatives who are affected by Alzheimer's. And I had to explain that what we had done is very, very different to an approach where you use some sort of cannabis strain. You don't know the cannabinoid content and the mix of cannabinoids in this plant. And this, just think then that this might be a therapeutically effective way to help relatives or your family members. But yeah, media obviously picks up on whatever sells the best story.
I wanted to ask, this kind of comes back to, this reminds me of my PhD exam when you asked me this question in relation to alcohol. But when we're talking about dosage, and you're talking about high, low dose, how well does it translate between mice doses for cannabis and human doses for taking high THC, low THC, high CBD, low CBD? How well does it translate? What are we talking about in terms of numbers?
So there is in pharmacology, there's a certain formula where you can try based on the body surface and the body volume to work out what a dose in a human might translate to in a mouse. The other way to do this is obviously if you know the, for example, behavioral effects of a certain compound, you can just try to dose it in a way that you achieve the same effects in your mice, which you would see in humans or the other way around. So when we talk about cannabinoids, in terms of the purified cannabinoids, so working on CBD or working on THC, we are able to relatively well model what you see in humans and in animals and compare it. So a high dose in our mice, for example, high dose THC would be 10 milligrams per kilogram body weight in an animal. So that would be a high dose THC in mice. If you inject them with this high dose, it probably would increase their anxiety. They would say show sedative effects, so they wouldn't move around a lot. It also, in all likelihood, if you give it chronically, it would impair their cognitive performance. A low-dose THC approach in mice would be something lower than 3 milligrams. Other people would probably argue it should go as low as 1 milligram per kilogram body weight. How does it translate into plant material? This is very hard to answer because there are so many different cannabis strains out there with so many different ratio of cannabinoids in the cannabis strain that it becomes near impossible to get any comparatively insight from using purified cannabinoids compared to cannabis strains. That's at the moment what the field tries to rectify. So in our lab, for example, we started off just using purified cannabinoids and we worked with doses of CBD, for example, anything between 5 milligrams per kilogram CBD to 100 milligrams per kilogram body weight CBD. And now we start looking at cannabis strains, which are high in CBD, which to a degree has the same ratio. So for example, at the moment we work with a cannabis strain, which when we inject it into the animals, they roughly get a mix of 3 milligrams of THC and 80 milligrams of CBD. And that would be classified as a CBD-rich cannabis strain. Be aware that most of the cannabis which is available, and it doesn't matter if this is now because you have a prescription for medicinal cannabis or if you buy it on the black market, most of these cannabis strains are very high on THC but very low in CBD. So what we are using had been specifically designed by a company to be able to look at a full cannabis extract and its effects on Alzheimer's compared to purified compounds, because obviously in the human world, people would be very interested to be able to have access to medicinal cannabis because it makes it cheaper and they get the potentially positive effects of all the other cannabinoids which are in the cannabis plant compared to just having one purified compound.
I just wanted to ask, in terms of, you talk about working with the companies to have the right strains and be able to study specifically what you're wanting to look at. How difficult has it been in your experience doing this kind of research to gain access to companies and to the ability to work with cannabis under certain governments that might have prevented this or not wanted this in the past? And how has that changed over time in terms of access?
So it has. I work on cannabinoids now for around 20 years. And that's obviously in Australian legislation, right? So back in the days, and that part hasn't changed that much. So if I want to use cannabinoids for research, I have to get approval I work in the state of New South Wales here in Australia. I need to get approval from New South Wales Health to be able to access these cannabinoids. To get them in the lab, I have to have a drug book. I have to write down how much we use for our experiments. That has to be linked to approved animal research protocols. Once they run out, the drug approval runs out. But it was, as long as I stayed within this legal framework, I had access at least to purified cannabinoids, because that's already back in the days. Companies would have produced them mostly though to look at detrimental effects. However, 10 to 15 years ago, they started obviously opening up the opportunity of having medicinal cannabis and legalizing medicinal cannabis. And even though that hadn't been written into legislation yet, lots of companies started to pop up. So suddenly, nearly every week, I got contacted by a new medicinal cannabis company, some of them highly professional, others not so much, who then said, we have these products available. Do you want to test them? For the first few years, I pretty much stayed away from this because I wanted to see how where the field settles and which companies are actually professional and can last and basically survive this initial rush. And by now, you, as a researcher, you have access to a lot of professional companies who are also able to make sure that the quality of the cannabis strains you receive is consistent across breeding cycles and across years. They check on the cannabinoid content. They don't check for 100 different cannabinoids, but they would check at the most 10 or 20 most likely cannabinoids which should be expressed. They might even able to provide some funding, because this type of research is obviously relatively expensive. In terms of the legislation around it, I still need approval from New South Wales Health. If I use products which are CBD focused, so cannabidiol focused, this is not there's a classification system in Australia. The highest classification, as far as I'm aware, is S8. So back in the days, all cannabinoids were S8. Nowadays, THC, which is the psychoactive component of cannabis, is still S8 classified. So for this, I need approvals and I have to have a drug book. If I use, for example, cannabidiol nowadays in my research, it's now classified as S4, which means I still have to notify New South Wales Health that I use it. but I don't have to be as strict about the bookkeeping as I was in the past. So that has eased up, but that's really just, I either would record how much I use or I don't. In terms of the access, I would say purified cannabinoids were always available. That hasn't really changed. It has obviously changed for patients, but for me as a researcher, it hasn't changed. I always had access to those. But I nowadays have access to a lot of cannabis strains and therefore cannabis extracts, which on the one side open up a lot of opportunities. On the other side, it also makes it harder because I could test out dozens of different CBD-rich cannabis extracts, which all have slightly different compositions of these different cannabinoids. And at the moment, I think the field struggles to work out what should we focus on. So even what is a THC or a CBD-rich strain, people not necessarily agree on what should be the percentage. So a lot of people would say anything which is has a THC content of over 20% is probably a THC-rich strain. But then for CBD, a lot of people would expect that the CBD content has to be higher than 20% to call it a CBD-rich strain. So it makes it more accessible, but it also makes it more complex because there are all these different strains out there. Different researchers work with different strains. And then even if the CBD content is the same, the content of the other cannabinoids might not be the same, so they might have different effects. So we are not all looking at the same, if you want to call it the same medication, which makes it hard to compare data and to compare outcomes. But yes, for me as a researcher, it hasn't changed that much. I have more opportunities. I think when you would talk to patients, for them, it has changed a lot over the last 10 years. They nowadays have, at least in Australia, they have a system how they can access cannabinoids. They are able to see, to a degree at least, the cannabinoid content of the cannabis extracts they are ordering. So that definitely, I would say, has improved because it is more controlled and people understand better what they are using.
That's really interesting. I wanted to ask, I feel you had mentioned that even when we talk about medical cannabis use, medical marijuana, they still have higher contents of THC or they're still THC rich. How is that still the case when, as far as you've told so far, most of the benefits seem to be from CBD and not from THC?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I had a look just in preparation for this podcast, and there are websites which are openly accessible where you can look at what is currently available as medicinal cannabis in Australia. And the THC rates go up to 30, 40, 50%, which is very potent cannabis in terms of its ability to induce a high. So that comes back to you find also other products, right? You find CBD-rich products, but I looked at random, I think there was a list of 150 compounds, and I think I looked at 100 of those. I would argue that most of those were still very high in THC. So there are two answers to the question. The one is, although THC induces a high, which some people might beneficial as well, I will not comment on that, but although it induces a high, it also has positive effects, THC in itself, right? It, for example, has been looked at in regards to how it can impact pain. It has been looked at, so it has, for example, also positive impact on if you have inflammation in your brain, THC compounds can reduce this inflammation, but it says it might come with a high. So I'm not saying that having that THC in itself doesn't have beneficial effects. The issue is it comes with potentially detrimental effects. Some people might just ignore those and say, but I get these beneficial effects. And if I also get a little bit high and if it also might impact on my cognitive functioning, I take that as a disadvantage or as a side effect. as we know, other medications, and I'm not talking about cannabinoids, the other medication have side effects as well. The other aspect to that is that people try to, so there's some research, if you just use purified THC and CBD compounds, you can, if you put them together, you can, depending on what you look at and depending on the ratio of these two compounds, you can use them together. And if you have high dose CBD, it might be able to block or reduce some of the detrimental effects of THC. So that means if I have a high dose THC cannabis strain, but it still has a certain ratio of CBD in it, the CBD, and that's at the moment still under investigation, right? There, again, you will find research publications which argue the one way or the other way. But you will find studies which show if there's a certain content of CBD in this cannabis strain, it will be able to at least reduce some of the detrimental symptoms which you get from THC. And as you had mentioned initially, for example, I also work and still do work on schizophrenia. And in the context of schizophrenia, using cannabis, which is highly potent for THC, is a real issue because that can increase your risk of psychotic relapse. It can make the severity of psychosis, can increase that as well. But what has been found is that if you give people who have schizophrenia, if you expose them to cannabis, which is just rich in THC, they always respond with more severe symptoms, and it's very detrimental. If you expose them to cannabis strains which have high CBD load as well, these negative effects disappear, so you can block them. So there is some evidence that strains which are relatively balanced on THC and CBD might not have many detrimental effects of the THC. But you are right that if you look at these databases, a lot of those are still very high in THC and very low in CBD. And in a lot of instances, the CBD content is less than 1%. And this is one of the, from my perspective, one of the problems in the field at the moment, that people argue a lot about the positives of medicinal cannabis. And I see in my own research, and when I go to conferences and look at other people's research, I see there's a definite place for medicinal cannabis because it can have positive effects. But if we don't address the issue of THC very clearly also having detrimental effects and try to get the people who access this type of medication to be aware that they should opt for CBD rich and ideally THC low cannabis extracts, you always will have to deal with potential negative effects by these people using medicinal cannabis. And unfortunately, when, for example, you look at the US and you look at Canada, where obviously medicinal cannabis has been legalized a few years ahead of time to what in Australia, for example, has happened, the number of people who are admitted to withdrawal clinics who mention that cannabis abuse is the main reason why they go to these clinics, that number has increased over the last 10 years. So you have to be aware that dependent on what medicinal cannabis product you're using, you still might be at risk to be exposed to some of the clearly established, and I have to say this very strongly here, it is clearly established that there are negative effects of abusing cannabis, especially if you do it at a very young age, especially if you do it when it's a THC potent cannabis strain. And this at the moment to a degree is ignored by the field, which is a real risk because it then induces new problems for the future, especially if this becomes even more available to people.
Just talking about the importance that you said in kind of realizing some of the negative effects, as well as going back to something that you said earlier. You did say that you had some research that some effects are not necessarily chronic. So once you stop, I think you're talking about preclinical models, but once you stop exposure after some time, your mice tend to return to levels normal to what you would see in mice which did not, in a mouse which did not take, was not exposed to cannabis or, yeah.
Yes, it was regards to cognitive performance, for example. Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So is there kind of, in that sense, is there kind of hope for people who were kind of admitted to these, to rehab clinics, or who took a lot of, used a lot of cannabis too young and then are seeing sort of detrimental effects? Is there like decent evidence to say that stopping also improves their performance later on, or is it more permanent in humans, I guess?
So I would assume that if you chronically, as a human, if you chronically abuse cannabinoids or cannabis, and at some stage you stop this, then obviously some of the effects will disappear. However, looking, for example, at schizophrenia, if you, and that has been established, cannabis is not a causal factor for schizophrenia. So I would argue that there's very limited evidence that just by abusing cannabis that you will develop schizophrenia. So it's not a causal factor, but a lot of research has been done, and I would say very clearly shows that cannabis is what we call a cumulative cause or a component cause for schizophrenia, which means that if you abuse cannabis, in particular at a young age, and what I mean with that is during adolescence, teenage years, young adulthood, and you are exposed to other risk factors for schizophrenia, that could be a genetic predisposition. Let's assume you have a family history. And quite often what you can hear is when people have a family history of schizophrenia, but they are themselves not affected by schizophrenia, when they use cannabis, they quite often report that they have very strong and to a degree negative, unpleasant effects of that abuse. And then in a lot of instances, these people stay away from abusing cannabis because they realize it might not be any good for me. But coming back to the research, it has been shown that if you have, for example, a genetic predisposition for schizophrenia and you smoke cannabis during adolescence, that you very significantly increase your risk to develop schizophrenia later on. If you have gone through that period, you have abused cannabis, you have this genetic position, you develop schizophrenia, you can't reverse that by then stopping to smoke cannabis. So at that stage, it is too late. I would also argue that if you, because adolescence is still a period where your brain matures and you know, certain synaptic setups are established. If you during that time abuse a lot of cannabis, that has an impact how your brain develops and how it matures. Even if you stop later on, that at least has initially been set up. So the effects will stay on for long term. If you talk about some of the behavioral effects, of course, you know, if you normally experience a high and you experience that you're a little bit withdrawn, once you are able to stop abusing cannabis, some of these symptoms will also disappear. But some of the risks involved with abusing cannabis to develop a dependence, and that might not, cannabis is obviously not as much of an addictive drug as cocaine or heroin, for example, that all has been established. But there is a level of dependency you develop with chronic abuse of cannabis that might be more on a psychological than a physiological level, but it's still there. Otherwise, you wouldn't have people going to withdrawal clinics and mentioning themselves that cannabis abuse is the first reason why they actually are coming to these clinics. So once this is established, it's obviously very hard to get out of this dependent cycle and also the psychology around it. So yes, certain effects, behavioral effects, will stop as soon as you stop abusing cannabinoids. The risk involved with abusing cannabis early in life can't be combated with that. It's too late at that stage. So people have to be very aware of that, because I know it's quite common that people start abusing cannabis early in life. I have two young kids myself. I wouldn't how do I say it? My way to educate them is to make them aware that the later you start testing out drugs, the better it is, because you know there's a critical period for brain maturation, and during that time, ideally, you don't want to be smoking cannabis every day. Later in life, if you know alcohol is a drug as well, they might get exposed to some of these drugs, and they will obviously test them out. But if they can hold off with it to a later period in their life, I think that would be a very sensible approach to this.
Oh, that's good. That's dispelling of life lessons as well at the same time for people. I know you have to go soon, so maybe we can talk about some of your current research. We did speak a little bit about your Alzheimer's work, but are there any other works which you do with regards to cannabis which you haven't covered, which we can talk about?
So we look at the moment, and it might make it even more complex, but we look at the moment. So on the one side, we just look in terms of therapeutic aspects of cannabinoids. We look at motor neuron disease. So we have mouse models for motor neuron disease. And at the moment, we actually expose them to CBD, just purified CBD, at different doses, to see if these animals have get some benefits out of being exposed to that. The reason is that some of the pathology and some of the changes in the organism when you're affected by motor neuron disease are not that dissimilar to Alzheimer's. So you also have, for example, high levels of oxidative stress in the brain, you have high levels of inflammation. So it could work there as well. So we are testing that out at the moment. But just to make it a little bit more complex, I have a postdoc who at the moment, or one of her research folky, is looking at drug addiction. And I'm not talking about THC, I have to be very clear here, but CBD has been looked at as a potential treatment against drug addiction. So she, for example, exposes animals to cocaine and sees if you co-treat them with CBD, if the tendency of these animals to develop a dependence to cocaine, and they develop that normally very quickly, if you can reduce this. And early research, and there are other researchers, for example, in Australia, you look at methamphetamine and they look at the effects of CBD. There's some research suggesting that CBD is able to be used at least as a as an add-on treatment for people with drug addiction. So at the moment, that's another path where we look at. And it might be that this is centrally regulated, so based on the effects of CBD on the endocannabinoid system, because that also might get activated by some of these other drugs. But it also looks like that it might have effects on the microbiome, so the bacteria in your gut, and that's at the moment a topic which is discussed quite widely in the field of brain disorders, because we understand more and more that the gut communicates with the brain. And it looks like that CBD impacts on the microbiome, so the condition of the gut and the bacteria in the gut, and thereby might have a positive effect on the brain, which then reduces your tendency to develop a drug dependence. So that's some of the research one of my postdocs is doing at the moment. So although cannabis is a drug, and although cannabis can induce a dependence in some form, certain ingredients of the cannabis plant actually might be able to combat that. But again, stressing here that most of the cannabis people would use is very low in CBD content. So it really depends on what cannabis strain you are talking here about. And we really look at the purified CBD compound. We are not looking at cannabis extracts. We take CBD, inject it into mice, and see how they then respond to, in our example, cocaine.
No, I feel I've heard of that, though, cannabis being used as a treatment for addictions before. So I'm pretty happy that it wasn't just like a fever dream, and someone's actually doing work on it, and there is some.
Yes, there are people who do it in humans as we speak. Yeah, that's correct. But as I said, it's in most cases, it would be a CBD compound. It wouldn't be cannabis extract.
Therese, do you have any final questions?
No, I'm good. It's all been really interesting. As someone who's not a mice person, a rat person, rat researcher, it's all like so interesting. And thank you so much for letting me be able to sit in and hear about your research.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. I really enjoyed it. And as I said, for some of the basics around cannabinoid biology, you probably talk better to someone who is a cannabinoid researcher, which I'm not. I just look at it from, this is one of different forms of medications out there. Is there evidence or is there any reason that we should look at that and test it in clinical trials? That's obviously always the reason why you do mouse research. People initially, when we started with this research 20 years ago, and obviously you need funding for this, so we went to funding bodies and tried to convince them to give us money to look at cannabinoids, to look at their effects on Alzheimer's, and we got knocked back for the first 5 or 6 years. And then when the medicinal cannabis discussion came on in Australia and the legislation changed, and suddenly that became that's a logical thing you should test. And so we were able to get some funding to test all of these different compounds and doses in our animals. But that's really only done to give some evidence to clinicians to be able to then run clinical trials. And I just looked this up before our meeting. That is currently happening. So in Australia as well as in the US, people look at CBD. People even look at THC. Again, why would they do this? THC can help with some of the agitation and some of the other symptoms Alzheimer's disease patients show at very late stage Alzheimer's. And then, Zahir, coming back to your question, at that stage, if they experience a little bit of a high because of THC, it's probably not that relevant. It is more relevant that the overall life quality at the end of unfortunately, their disease progression is improved, and therefore people are happy to test it out. So at the moment, there are quite a few clinical trials in the US looking at THC, but also CBD in the context of Alzheimer's and how it might help with some of the psychomotor and agitational issues patients experience at late stage Alzheimer's. So we just try to trigger those developments, and you have to test somewhere or you have to start somewhere. And that's why we start with the mice, being very well aware that this is obviously a limited model compared to what you then later on would do in humans.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of treatments, there's another treatment which I've heard of, which is common, but you didn't really mention it, and that was in cancers. I don't know which strain is considered to be useful in it, but cannabis being used in cancer treatment to some extent as well.
That is true. But there again, it's really important that you read the fine print, because a lot of these treatments are more to stimulate appetite in cancer patients when they are going through chemotherapy, to help with the pain and the feeling sick. So it's not necessarily to treat the cancer. It is a lot of times to help the overall life quality and the life condition of people who are undergoing chemotherapy at the time. There is some evidence that cannabinoids might be able to reduce cancers, but a lot of that is in vitro. So not even in a mouse model yet. So that's in cell dishes. So they have cells which develop cancers, and they treat these cells with cannabinoids, and the cells then recover better or are able to be protected against a cancer insult. That hasn't really been followed up comprehensively in mouse models or humans yet. So when you see that cannabinoids are used for cancer therapy, a lot of times it's actually to help with some of the symptoms based on the chemotherapy. It's not necessarily to treat the cancer itself. I have to be very clear here, because I see all these news flashes as well. And then when you actually go into the publications, you can see that it's either in vitro work, so in a dish, or it was really around some of the detrimental negative effects when you undergo chemotherapy. But it is true. It is used in that regard.
Awesome. I think we can essentially end there. Usually for the last bit, we do a few just general quick fire questions, but I'm not sure how much time you have.
Five more minutes, if that's okay.
5 more minutes? All right. Chris, should we ask like 3 questions each then? And
sure,
we can end there. Sweet. Awesome. So Chris, you can ask the first one.
Summer or winter?
Summer.
Movies or TV shows?
Movies.
If you could live anywhere in the world, where would it be?
Australia, where I live right now.
Fair enough. Which superpower would you like to have?
Ooh. I discuss this a lot with my kids. Either it would be flying, or because I'm a scuba diver, or I would be able to breathe underwater. If that's a superpower, that for me would be a superpower. One of the two.
No, that's nice.
Probably flying. I don't know.
Arguably the most important one, cats or dogs?
Oh, we have 2 cats, which doesn't mean that I don't like dogs. I like dogs a lot, but our cats wouldn't go along with dogs. So, cats.
Awesome. And then the last question, which we ask everybody, if you had to leave our listeners with a piece of advice, what would it be?
Sorry, can you say that again? I didn't hear that. If you have your...
So if you have to leave us and our listeners with one piece of advice before you leave, what would it be?
Pay attention to what cannabis you are accessing in case you have a reason to access cannabis. Not every cannabis is the same.
Fair enough. No, that's good. Thank you so much, Tim. Thanks, Chris, for joining. And thanks, everyone, for listening. See you guys.
Thanks for having me. Much appreciated. I hope you can make something out of it. I know I have a strong German accent, so yeah. I'm not offended if you cut it down to 3 minutes. That's totally up to you.
it was great. I'm sure it will be absolutely fine. All right. Take care, guys.
Thank you.